And as early as the Civil War, there had been provisions made by the American government. Abraham Lincoln was very understanding of the pacifist position. His heart was torn by the situation that he was in, not liking war, but not liking slavery. And he understood that the Quakers were as opposed, if not more opposed, to slavery than he was. And therefore, he couldn't quite say that in the North, at least, the Quakers who refused to take part in the Civil War were pro-South or pro-slavery. In the Southern states, in the Civil War, of course, Quakers were not so favorably. They were known to be opposed both to slavery and the war there, but the South was in sympathy with both slavery and with their role in the Civil War. On the whole, the Quakers in the South during the war suffered more difficulty than the Quakers in the North. The members of Lincoln's cabinet were some of them very liberal in this matter, but Lincoln personally was so. But in spite of that, there was a draft law, and there were no general provisions at first, so that men that were conscripted, if they were Quakers, were simply ultimately taken by force and carried to the barracks and had their guns strapped to them and given orders, and if they declined the orders, they would be punished. There's a recent pamphlet published, the diary of a man named Cyrus Pringle, P-R-I-N-G-L-E. Extraordinarily able botanist he became afterwards, but he went through a pretty tough time in the New Englander, first up in New England and then down in Washington as a conscientious objector. In the Civil War, ultimately, a suggestion was made that if the friends who carried on negotiations, the older friends with the government, if the friends would contribute so much for the help of the freedmen, that is, the free slaves, who were in a desperate plight, of course, this gift would be regarded as equivalent to their doing military service when drafted. It was also possible for a man that was drafted to pay for a substitute. A few hundred dollars, and you could just pay for a substitute. And the government would hire a soldier as a soldier, a man that hadn't been drafted. The draft was not universal. A good deal of it was done by lot, and done in stages, each time a new quota of men would be asked for from a district or a state, and then they'd have to provide that many men. And if the lot fell on a friend that took this position, he had the option of paying not a very large sum of money. I think it was $300. Of course, that was more then. Yes?
A Quaker wouldn't feel right, though, in paying to have someone else go in his place to war, would he?
Well, the government thought he might.
Well, but have the Quaker feel...
And a good many of them didn't, quite right. On the other hand, it sometimes happened that a man that took this position, a young man, would have, say, an uncle who didn't share. He didn't want his nephew to go to war. He would just pay it for him without any and it would all be settled with the government, and the young man couldn't do much about it. He was exempt now. Now, this again, this whole problem of whether you'll take the alternative office is one of the things that has bothered the Quaker perhaps more than whether he would go at all. The question is the alternative satisfactory? Or is the alternative itself accepting the principle of doing something either for the war or in place of someone else that does it for the war, that sort of thing? But I think you see, the government thought it was entirely unreasonable for anybody to object to this sort. This was a very generous thing to do. And they felt it was generous, and they thought it was they thought it was a way of showing respect for conscience. And they did it with the best intentions. The fact of the matter is, of course, that a lot of them wouldn't accept this alternative. And even in another situation where you find yourself already in the military camp, as many of them got there, there'd be some question of what you would do when you got there. Obviously, there are some things you wouldn't do, but if you were under a sympathetic or at least a sensitive and bothered officer, because these conscientious objectors are awful nuisance to a nation mobilized for war. Really, my heart bleeds sometimes for a government that's trying to carry on a war and have these very awkward people to deal with. Obviously sincere. I've had some talk with Mr. Hershey, who ran it during the Second World War, and he was a very liberal fellow. A man named Dykstra, a college president from the West, was in charge of some of it. And as I said, in Lincoln's cabinet, Secretary of War and Secretary of Agriculture were, I don't know but one of them was a friend. At any rate, one of them was a Mennonite, very sympathetic. So, I can give you the history of what the government has offered in order to satisfy the conscience. It hasn't always worked. I think I'm right in saying that mostly these things are done out of a respect for religious conscience, though not always a deep understanding of religious conscience. And if you can offer this, say, of course, we believe in freedom of conscience, pretty widespread view in America at least, and in most modern countries, then if it's not accepted, you say how ungrateful these conscientious people are. I think I'll read you a section from the account of this man Pringle, just before we go further. It's, you recognize I'm reading from a book I mentioned before, which has a great deal of varied information on this subject. Margaret Hearst's The Quakers in Peace and War. Cyrus Pringle's home was up on the Lake Champlain. And when a quota of men was taken from there, he and two or three other friends that lived up there were brought down to by the military authorities, brought down to Boston, and put in a camp there. And then from that camp, they later moved down south near Washington, and they had various experiences. They were in Camp Vermont, Boston Harbor. They were unwilling to accept the concession that if they would do hospital duty or put in charge of the colored refugees, they could be exempted from military service, because all this would be done under military control. This naturally hardened the authorities against them. They were transferred from one camp to another. At Culpeper, the colonel, who was unwilling to treat them harshly, urged them to work in the hospital tents, as the in the camp. The boys were shaken and perplexed by his arguments. Cyrus Pringle's own words are a typical expression of the mind of those who conscientiously object to any service under military control, and who thus present the government with a problem not easy to solve. Regarding the work, he says, as one of mercy and benevolence, looking after the sick, we asked if we had any right to refuse its performance, and questioned whether we could do more good by endeavoring to bear to the end a clear testimony against war than by laboring by word and deed among the needy in the hospitals and camps. We saw around us a rich field of usefulness in which there were scarce any laborers, hardly any orderlies in the hospital, and towards whose work our hands have often started involuntarily and unbidden. At last we consented to a trial. So they went into the hospital. After an honest attempt, the three friends found the position impossible. Pringle writes with unwonted strength of language, "They were days of going down into sin. I have received a new proof that no friend who is really such, desiring to keep himself clear of all complicity with the system of war and to bear a perfect testimony against it, can lawfully perform service in the hospitals of the army instead of bearing arms." So they refused after this trial. They refused to continue in the hospital. Then the colonel said he would make no more effort to relieve them, adding that a man who would not fight for his country did not deserve to live. Next day, the lieutenant in charge ordered Pringle to clean a gun. I replied to him that I could not comply with military requisitions and that I felt resigned to the consequences. "I do not ask about your feelings," said the officer. "I want to know if you're going to clean that gun." "I cannot do it," was my answer. He went away saying, "Very well," and I crawled again into my tent. Two sergeants soon came for me and, taking me a little to one side, bid me lie down on my back, and stretching my limbs apart, tied cords to my wrists and ankles, and to these four stakes driven into the ground, somewhat in the form of an X. I was very quiet in my mind as I lay there on the ground, soaked with the rain of the previous day, exposed to the heat of the sun, and suffering cruelly from the cords binding my wrists and straining my muscles. And if I dared the presumption, I should say that I caught a glimpse of heavenly pity. I wept not so much from my own sufferings as from sorrow that such things should be done in our country, where justice and freedom and liberty of conscience had been the annual boast of 4th of July orators so many years. It seemed that our forefathers in the faith had wrought and suffered in vain when the privileges they so dearly bought were soon set aside. And I was sad that one endeavoring to follow our dear master should be so generally regarded as a despicable and stubborn culture. Well, there's a religious response, you see, to this situation. And the rest of the story is a further difficulty. They were transferred down the neighborhood of Washington. And finally, three older friends that knew about their plight secured a interview with the President, President Lincoln, and President Lincoln sent word, "Send those boys home." Subject, of course, to call. In order to protect himself against violating the law or making the parents of boys that were in the service jealous of this kind of treatment, he conformed to the law. But he knew perfectly well that these boys would never make good military material, and he didn't see any point in pestering them this way. It's kind of thing that Lincoln did, not only to conscientious objectors, but also the boys that failed at military duty. A boy went to sleep on guard, was about to be shot. And while the Quakers were there asking about these boys, the mother of that boy came in, and he had the boy pardoned. Well, that was Lincoln's personal intervention. You can't count on that sort of thing, but that was the kind of experience they had. My father was next in line to be called for military service in his district. After several other calls had come, you know, they were arranged, and they never were called. This was the last call that had taken place. The war was soon over. But I never quite knew, but I think he had no intention of paying any alternative, but taking the punishment that would come from refusing either to pay, although he was already engaged in relief work for the freedmen, the Negroes, very active in that. When it came to doing his substitution for military duty, he wouldn't do it. In the First World War, the problem came to friends, the first in England, in a more extensive way. And conscription came in 1916. Already the war had been going on 2 years when conscription came, and the Friends in England had already organized for civilian relief work under civilian control, partly working in what was called the Friends Ambulance Unit in France, and very close to the front lines and helping with the care of the wounded, and also in another organization working for the civilians who, as the waves of war moved on the French-German frontier, the French civilians had been moved back. There were a lot of displaced people without homes or anything. They were working with them. And then conscription came. And the conscription law in England was somewhat liberal in form. It provided for, in the first place, that some men who were known to be religious, conscientious objectors would be completely exempted. Well, I think they found 30 in the whole country that they treated that way.